Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Corinne Warsawski, founder, Tribal Gatherings for Young Adults. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our Shinshinim, Chen Denachi and Tamir Shukuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. After a great deal of build-up, we've finally arrived at Israel's 70th anniversary. Of course, it depends which calendar you use to determine the actual date of the birthday of the Jewish state. But we have at the very least arrived at the Hebrew calendar celebration, the fifth day of the month of Iyar, which this year corresponded to April 19th, that was last Thursday. The entire week has been celebrated with great energy and creativity throughout Israel, and it continues to be celebrated throughout the Jewish world right up through today. Now, you may have heard, perhaps here on Too Jewish, that the U.S. Embassy will move to Jerusalem in time for the 70th anniversary of Israel in May 2018. That can be confusing. The confusion is easy to understand when you realize that the Jewish lunar calendar and the American, and more broadly the Western, solar-based calendar vary a fair amount against each other. 70 years ago, back in 1948, when Israel's independence began, the 5th of Iyar fell on May 14th, 1948, and while the U.S. extended best wishes on the Hebrew calendar day last week, the American Embassy is scheduled to formally take on that status in Jerusalem on the Western solar version of the calendar next month. You got that? There will be a short exam at the conclusion of Too Jewish this morning. As we have explained from time to time here on Too Jewish, this variation between the solar and lunar calendars is normal, and the difference can be as much as a full month from one year to the next. That's why Rosh Hashanah can fall anywhere from the early part of September, when it comes this fall, 2018, up to the early part of October. And Hanukkah has come as early as Thanksgiving within recent memory, and as late as the very end of December. It all gets worked out with the addition of a leap month on the Jewish calendar, and over a 19-year cycle, the lunar system is perfectly regular. But it's also why Hebcal is a semi-popular Jewish website, and why it's very handy to have a good Jewish calendar app on your phone just to check when the holidays actually occur. In the case of Yom HaAtzma'ut, the 70th anniversary of Israel's Independence Day, it has therefore already occurred last week, and it still will occur in May when the U.S. Embassy opens for business in Jerusalem. Almost like Schrodinger's cat or something. Well, maybe not. Anyway, an extra Jewish Independence Day for Israel. All the more reason to rejoice, no? And so to play us in this morning, here's an appropriate melody for Israel's birthday, no matter which month it falls in, the classic Eretz Eretz, the land I love, my mother and father, the eternal land where I was born and will continue to be, the land of the Torah, come what may. If you will it, it is no dream. Eretz Eretz, sung by Ilanit.
Eretz Eretz Eretz, Eretz Tchol Einav, VeHashemesh Lakidevash. Eretz ba nolatnu, Eretz ba nichye, v'neshev ba yiye, ma sheyiye. Eretz shenohav, hilanu emevav, Eretz shelaham, Eretz leolam, Eretz ba nolatnu, Eretz ba nichye, yiye ma sheyiye.
Yeah.
That was Eretz. Eretz for Israel's 70th Independence Day last week, and I guess next month too, and the continuing celebration of this landmark birthday for the Jewish state. Our guest this morning, Corinne Warsawski, is the founder of the remarkable program Tribal Gatherings for Young Adults, an experience of Jewish camp for people who are fully grown up. Hear about this dynamic woman and hear from her why it's so important and what's involved and, well, how you can do it if you want when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Corinne Warsawski is the creator of a remarkable organization called Tribal Gatherings. It's kind of camp, Jewish camp for young adults. Tell us where it all came from and how it works.
Hi, Sam. It's great to meet you. Great to be here. So the story of Tribal Gatherings started when I was still working in the Jewish travel world. I spent about a decade working with Birthright, Jewish teen travel providers, and I loved it. I loved taking people around the world and using immersive experiences as a way to bridge them back to their Jewish culture. And but at the end of the day, I am a camp person. I grew up going to camp in the Berkshires, halfway between New York and Boston. And when I was 15, I always wanted to be a camp director. And it never happened because I found myself working in Jewish travel, which is close, but not the same. And years ago, when I was living in D.C. working with Birthright, I spent my weekends working for Living Social, which eventually got acquired by Groupon. But they opened an adventures division. And on weekends, we would spend our days taking hundreds of young adults on really creative experiences all around the D.C. area. And then that scaled to 25 cities nationally. And I was thinking, why don't I do this for the Jews? This is such a creative way to get people plugged into community. And our events were like vinyasa and vineyards and horseback riding and wine tasting and Canadian for a night where we would go curling and then drink somewhere. And and one of the events was Camp for Adults. And I had so much fun working with these people, and they totally got camp and they got me and they got like the notion of what makes community special, that I went and spoke with Living Social executives to see if there was a way that we could bring Birthright alumni into their space. But the timing wasn't right because Birthright Next got a massive grant and Living Social was huge. So nothing really happened. But 3 years later, Living Social got acquired by Groupon. Birthright Next obviously doesn't exist anymore. And I was graduating from business school and got really excited by entrepreneurship. And I said, you know what? Practice what you preach. This is the time to take a risk. And I want to see what I can do. So I started by surveying about 40,000 Birthright alumni asking, what kinds of things do you guys want to do when you're back home? And the response was overwhelmingly that they wanted 3 to 5 day, all-inclusive experiences within a 3-hour driving radius of home, and Tribal Gatherings was born.
I got your whole business plan there. That's fantastic. you know, to me, one of the fascinating changes that we've seen over a long period of time, I guess it's 50, 60 years, but the way the Jewish identity is forged by going to Jewish camp. And you then, you know, you go to college and maybe you're a counselor, maybe not, and you don't ever really have that experience again.
That's totally the point. I heard somebody very brilliant recently say that they think the future of Jewish affiliation is camp. That people identify what camp they went to as their sort of like brand of Jewish identity. And that's very much in line with the kinds of people who come to tribal experiences. They come from 3 different categories. Knowing that most people kind of end their camp career either as a camper or as a staff member in their early 20s, it's really hard for them to re-engage in that immersive environment or frankly recreate the best days of their lives. Everybody's nostalgic for summer, and they're in their best when they're in their youth, and people are nostalgic for that. So what I'm trying to do is bridge the gap between Birthright and camp and create a space where we get to recreate the environments that were so special to our Jewish identities. And it's funny, the people who come to camp, like, all kind of have a relation to camp, whether or not they went. So I call them the FOMOs, the nostalgics, and the do-overs. So the FOMOs we get a lot of FOMOs. FOMOs are people who never went to camp, but their friends did, and they always wanted to go, and for whatever reason, they didn't. So now is the time for them to come and see what Wet Hot American Summer looks like in real life, or, like, go to a weekend that, like, really channels Dirty Dancing and, like, let them fulfill their fantasies. The nostalgics for people who grew up going to camp, Jewish or not Jewish, day camper overnight, but, like, they get it. And, like, the get it is in quotes. And they love camp, and they know how powerful and fun it is, and they want to get back to that space, and they want to be a kid again. They want to be able to do things they don't have access to on a daily basis, and kind of, like, live in a carefree, noise-free world where you can just have authentic relationships and connections to people. And then the do-overs are the best. So the do-overs are people who maybe went to camp and they were 8 for a week and then got homesick and never came back for whatever reason, had a bad experience. And now they're 30 and they have disposable income and they need to redeem themselves. And so here's a chance for them to, like, be a color war captain, like, prove to themselves that they've made it and, like, they can make friends and, like, they have a great time. And the FOMO, the do-overs are often the most fun people. So, by the way, so are the FOMOs, because, like, they want to soak it all in. So it's true, like, no matter whether people went to camp or didn't go to camp, like, everyone has a relationship to what camp looks and feels like. And this gives people a chance to come and experience it all over again or for the first time.
Wow, fantastic. We will talk much more with Corinne Warsawski about tribal gatherings and find out what it's like to go back to camp when we return in just a moment here on 2 Jewish.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We're enjoying the 70th birthday of the State of Israel this week, and as part of our build-up for this huge celebration, 2 Jewish includes spots from both our Israeli Shin Shinim and our Maven on Israel.
We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker O, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Big day, the celebration of Israel's 70th birthday, Yom HaAtzmaut. Fantastic celebration. Talk a little bit for our listeners about what this 70th anniversary, what this birthday means for you personally.
Mm-hmm. You know, so first, you know, on a personal level, growing up in Israel, I had teachers who fought dwarf independence. It's crazy just to think about it, you know.
It may be like an American growing up and knowing George Washington.
Absolutely. So that's one. And then we're young. 70 years is nothing compared
nothing
to the States, you know.
And America countries is nothing compared to England and America. Right, you know, go on throughout the countries around
right,
the world.
So we're young, but, you know, we accomplished so much in such a short time. And it's very dear to me to celebrate this day. And obviously to remember those who paid the highest price in order for us to have that.
You know, and having commemorated that at Yom HaZikaron, today is now, although we remember those serious moments, a time of real celebration. Mm-hmm. You know, the first time I went to Israel, I've talked about this on the show before, Israel was a poor country. This was the mid-70s, and the food wasn't very good, and there weren't any amenities anywhere that I can recall.
Different now.
It was a great experience. The right people were energetic, but right, it's such a different place.
It is.
How does it feel to you? Like, you've lived through such change in not a very long period of time.
Look, I remember growing up when my dad came from the States, you know, back to Israel after a visit. And we the children were like looking forward to it, and then he would come into the house and we would run to the suitcase and would open the suitcase and there'll be things that we never had in Israel, you know, silly things, you know, like the bubble gum that has like liquid in it, you know?
Oh yeah.
So anyway, I grew up with black and white TV and then seeing, you know, the color
TV. Two channels or three channels. Maybe.
One.
One channel, right?
One.
Unless you got Jordanian TV by accident.
Yeah, I don't count that. But, you know, Israeli TV. We had one channel. You know, Thursday night was Maccabi Tel Aviv basketball team night. So basically,
on the little black and white set.
Correct. And every single household will just, you know, watch the game. The streets were empty. There was a pointless to open any store.
It was a total cultural experience. You know, I remember when I lived in Israel, we learned a new word, mikubal, which meant to install the cable for TV, and suddenly there was multiple channels available.
Right.
You could get MTV in those days. It's so much more advanced now. It's extraordinary.
It is. Basically, today, you know, you can find anything you want in Israel.
It's absolutely a first world country.
Of course.
Tell us a little bit about some of the rest that we talked the last few weeks about, the incredible celebration at the fields near the JCC going on today from 1 to
6.
There's going to be great children's activities too, right?
Right. So our Shinshinim Chen V'Tamir,
who you all know from the Two Jewish Radio Show, and there are multiple appearances here.
And so they researched Israel and wanted to see what we have that can be connected to the children area. So they looked at Chulon, which is a city outside of Tel Aviv. You know, it's funny. Everything in Israel is close to, outside of. So Chulon.
It's not a big country.
I know. So Chulon is marketed as the children's city. So, and it has a lot of attractions for children.
For kids, yeah.
So what we've done was we contacted Chulon City Hall and the mayor and asked them to send us things. And they send us, you know, T-shirts and hats and flags. And so we're building a children area that will connect children to Israel, educate them about Israel in a fun and engaging way.
Sounds wonderful. There's lots of other things, a great dance troupe, an incredible hall of technologies, great food, a silent DJ party. Come to the JCC or come to the free Israel Festival, this incredible celebration of Israel's 70th birthday today.
Looking forward to see everyone there.
Thanks so much.
Leitraut.
Leitraut.
See you later.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Tamir Shakuri and Chen Dinachi. Well, Chag Sameach, Yom Ha'atzma'ut Sameach. This is the 70th anniversary of Israel, 70th birthday. It's a huge, huge celebration worldwide. Bevakasha, tell us about your thoughts on this really remarkable time, remarkable moment in history.
Wow. Well, Israel's been around for 70 years. That's amazing. I mean, my grandma's still older, but still amazing. I think it's really cool that we still have people from before the country was established, which I'm guessing you people in America don't.
No, we don't have anyone from before 1776. I think that's a fair statement. That there are living people who, in their memory, you know, there's still, you know, a fair number of people who are survivors of the War of Liberation, of the Independence War in 1948.
Yeah. No, really. And it's really amazing to meet people who like started this country, and to see what we've accomplished in 70 years is just amazing. Because from nothing, from swamps to being a first world country with so many developments, selling technology to the world, it really makes me proud to live where I live. And, you know, it's a country full of Jews. So if we don't have our brains, what do we have?
It's all based in intelligence. Tamir, you know, this is an interesting thought. Israel was founded really as an agricultural country. Jews were getting back to the land. A smaller and smaller percentage of Israelis even work in agriculture. You know, you come from a moshav, but that's not the standard thing now, is it?
No, and moshavim and kibbutzim are not what they used to be, honestly. So if you're planning on going on a trip to Israel and looking in a moshav and seeing people working outside with the cows and with like, so no.
The new Jews picking Jaffa oranges, which they almost don't grow anymore.
Yeah, not so much. I live in a moshav, and we do have a lot of land where people are, some of the people are still like growing crops, and I think it's really great. I think it's also great for me to live in a moshav where I took an active part in my friends' like parents' or uncles' like field. That's when we are looking for a like summer job, then that's what we do. And I think it's a really cool experience, and it's kind of like connecting you to the land, connecting you to Israel, to
the history of Zionism, for that matter, right?
Yeah.
But
my dad and my mom, my dad is a high tech worker. He works at Intel, and my mom is a teacher. So we don't really get the farmer's aspect,
right.
But it's still really great to wake up in the morning and take my dog to a trip to the field, and rather than going down the street and in the city. I'm not really a city person. more of a moshav person right now. So I think it's really, it was a really great experience. And seeing the moshavim develop, I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily to have
just
a
just
modern
moshav.
The
way the
moshav.
World goes. Right.
Yeah, because there are still people that hold the lands in the moshav, but it's grown to a point where people from all over the country, if they want some peace and quiet and a quality community, they choose to go to a moshav, and I think it's very welcomed. And 70 years did well for the moshavim.
You know, it's fascinating. It's like when Jews settled in the yeshuv originally, when they moved to Israel and began to work the land, they worked the land because that was the only way they could make a living. It was changing the world. Now, Israel has transformed to the point where it's such a high-tech, fast-moving country. People now go to those same places to find the peace and quiet. There was plenty of peace and quiet in the old days. Now there's so much going on.
Yep.
Well, Mazel Tov, a great celebration of Yom Ha'atzmaut.
Tada.
Tada.
The Boy Scouts of America have gone through many changes over the last 5 years, and you may not know about them. The Boy Scouts now include boys who are members of the LGBT community and leaders from the LGBT community. Just last year, a pilot program for boys 5 years old and in kindergarten was added, and a family program for girls 5 through 9 years old who can now join Cub Scouts. A key Boy Scout law says a scout is reverent, and duty to God is now a component for scout rank. Interfaith prayer is used whenever members of multiple faiths are present. In the early 70s, some Jewish organizations dropped sponsorship of scouting because of the lack of inclusion, but it's time for the Jewish community to return to its support for this great organization. Judaism shares principles that are represented and taught by the Boy Scouts of America. Scouting's a great place to inculcate good values and a shared philosophy, and develop better adjusted and contributing young people who will become future leaders. Scouting is more than camping. It's a variety of activities promoting physical and mental health and emotional growth. Scouting schedules activities so as not to interfere with religious and other family activities and to include other members of the nuclear family. Scouting's an enhancement of religious, communal, and familial life. And that's true from the youngest level of scouting. Currently, only one unit chartered by a Jewish organization, PAC 613 in Tucson, exists in the state of Arizona. If you are in the Tucson area, contact Herb at Shofarman, Shofarman, at AOL.com, or call the Catalina Council at 520-750-0385. That's 750-0385. New members are very welcome in the scouting family. Scouting's there for all members, in good times and bad, helping in every way. Contact the Scouting Council in your area. Go to www.beascout.org. or www.my.scouting.org. Ask your local council if they have a Jewish committee on scouting who can come to your synagogue or organization and see if scouting is just the thing to further your mission to the community. You can also contact the National Jewish Committee on Scouting, www.jewishscouting.org. Scouting is great for you and your family. We're exploring Israel's 70th anniversary, 70 years, to be biblical about it, with a special Two Jewish feature, a look at every decade of Israel's existence from 1948 to 2018 through a headline, or some headlines from that year, and a signature melody as well. This morning we continue this process, reviewing the history of the Jewish state, 70 years of Israel in 7 weeks, on to decade six with a headline from the 1990s. There are two headlines from the 90s that capture the complexity, passion, and horrifying disappointment of that crucial period of Israel's history. The first was one of the most dramatic and terrible moments in all of Israel's 70 years. It came November 4, 1995, the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin at a peace rally in Kings of Israel Square in support of the Oslo agreements. The 1990s began with the end of the First Intifada, the first Gulf War, and the slow start of a long process of movement towards peace between Israel and the Palestinians. The first dramatic steps were taken after the end of the Gulf War at a conference in Madrid in the fall of 1991, facilitated by heavy U.S. diplomatic efforts under President George Bush and his Secretary of State, James Baker. That initial first meeting, which included representatives of the key Arab states, Israel and the Palestinians, began a process that continued secretly with Israeli direct negotiations with the PLO on the one hand and with Jordan on the other. The results were the 93 Oslo Accords with the Palestinians and the 94 and 95 treaties with Jordan. I was friends with Israeli soldiers who participated in joint patrols with Palestinian police during the era that followed. I was with a group of Reform rabbis who met with the leadership of the Palestinians in Gaza City during a memorable trip to Egypt, Israel, and Jordan in that period. Then I first met Shimon Peres and a still young Bibi Netanyahu. But it was the murder of Yitzhak Rabin, the tough realist who had taken the risky step of negotiating peace with the Palestinians, that changed the course of history, and not for the better. Rabin was assassinated by a religious Jew who believed the Oslo process was endangering Israel's security. And what has followed has included a second intifada, the withdrawal of Israel from Lebanon and from Gaza, and wars on both fronts. The era of high-minded, idealistic songs and dreams for peace and a permanent two-state solution, well, they seem like long-lost memories now. What the Oslo process really did change permanently was Israel's economy. And the second headline from the 90s came in 1998, exactly 20 years ago. In April 1998, the Azrieli complex of skyscrapers, Israel's tallest, opened. It highlighted a revolutionary change in the Israeli economy in the 90s, from a still struggling agricultural and mixed economic model to a fast-paced, high-tech engine of development. When I lived in Jerusalem from 91 to 92, we were excited to be just getting cable TV, Mikubal, they called it, and moving from two or three channels to being able to see MTV Europe. Telephone service was expensive and terrible. When I returned to Israel 4 years later, everyone had at least two cell phones, and the peacetime economy had Israel making deals with every nation in Europe and lots of American high-tech firms. A huge part of that surge was fueled by the immigration of over a million Jews from the suddenly fallen Soviet Union, who brought skills, scientific knowledge, and great energy on an unprecedented level to Israel. The absorption of the Russian Jews and the Ethiopian Jews who came at the beginning of the 1990s and their rapid integration into the now booming Israeli economy began a financial and developmental climb that has accelerated ever after. Still, our 1990s song for the decade was written by Aviv Geffen, sung by Arik Einstein at the memorial for Yitzhak Rabin. Livkot Lecha, I'll cry for you, in memory of Yitzhak Rabin and the Oslo peace process.
Ani ole, livkot lecha, tiye chazak lemala. Gaguai, kemo dlatot sheni. תחות בלילה לנצח אחי אזכור אותך תמיד וניפגש בסוף אתה יודע ויש לי חברים אבל גם הם קווים אל מול אורך המשגע כשעצובים הולכים לים לכן הים עלוח וזה עצוב שלהחזיר ציוד אפשר לא געגוע לנצח אחי אזכור אותך תמיד וניפגש בסוף אתה יודע ויש לי חברים אבל גם הם קווים אל מול אורך המשגע וכמו הגלים אנחנו מתנפצים אל המזח אל החיים וכמו הגלים אנחנו מתנפצים אל המזח אל החיים
That was our sixth weekly Two Jewish celebration of 70 years of Israel in 7 weeks, memories from the headlines of the 90s. You know, like many people, I remember just where I was when I heard Yitzhak Rabin was shot. It was a 9/11 or Pearl Harbor moment for Israelis, but also for Jews everywhere in the world who care about Israel. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We talked a little bit about anti-Semitism the last couple of weeks. The origins of anti-Semitism go back, well, profoundly deeply into history, but in particular, much of the anti-Semitism in the West originates in the concept that Jews killed Jesus, that we committed the great and permanent sin of deicide. Let's explore that a little bit and its implications even today.
Well, as you know, I taught for many years a course at the university called A History of Anti-Semitism. And I spent a lot of time on pre-Christian history because there's a lot of evidence that the ancient Greeks who ruled over Israel from the 4th century before Jesus was even born and the ancient Egyptians who were in power almost two millennia before Jesus was born, were anti-Semitic. And in many of the same ways, in terms of negative stereotypes and discrimination and active hate crimes and destruction of the temple. The Greeks' particular form of desecrating the Second Temple was one of the factors that led to the Maccabean Revolt,
and
which
Hanukkah.
We commemorate on Hanukkah. So, I mean, there's... You know, it's too facile to say that anti-Semitism began with the birth of Christianity or the charge of deicide or whatever. But you're absolutely right that deicide plays an important role in the history of anti-Semitism, particularly in the history of Christian anti-Semitism, which is only a small percentage of global anti-Semitism. And we should examine. I mean, this term obviously means the killing of God. It's related to homicide, matricide, fratricide, et cetera, et cetera.
They use the
even
word,
suicide,
the
right?
Latin name for God, and so deicide, the killing of God, right?
So in that context, it's important to note that the early Christians themselves didn't agree until the middle of the 4th century at the Council of Nicaea that Jesus was, in fact, God. There were lots of different opinions about this question. And even after the Council of Nicaea in the middle of the 3rd century, there were still people who didn't quite believe it, or they didn't believe it in the same sense as the Council decreed it. So there were still both...
Series of heresies that followed, right?
Well, not only heresies, but schisms and wars, both wars of words and wars with weapons in which people were killed well into the Middle Ages and culminating with the Great Schism in the 11th century. So even once it was decided that Jesus was God, theoretically at this very important church council for many reasons, the Council of Nicaea, convened by Constantine the Great, for whom Constantinople is named, even after that, it wasn't an instant or a universal decision to accuse the Jews of this crime. That became a widespread belief only at the beginning of the 5th century. So there were a few hundred years when Jews and Christians coexisted without one group branding the other as the killers of God. But there was still anti-Semitism in that period. So I think that it's fair to say that in the Christian world, the charge of deicide and the history of anti-Semitism are very closely linked. They're not identical, and there's plenty of anti-Semitism absent the charge of deicide, and there was the charge of deicide without necessarily the consequence of anti-Semitism, at least in the 4th and 5th centuries of the Common Era.
Well, that gets us to almost only 1,500 years ago. We can pick it up next time. Thanks so much, Tom. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. It's a very hot day in the Jewish neighborhood. When Jack Gold steps out of the shower, he says to his wife, Sadie, "It's too hot to wear clothes today, honey. What do you think the neighbors will say if I mow the lawn without anything on?" Sadie looks at him and replies, "That I married you for your money." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Two Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Emor, our Torah portion this week in Leviticus, begins as so many others do. God gives commands to the people of Israel. But the language this time is a little different. Usually, commandments begin with the Hebrew word daber, speak to the children of Israel, or occasionally tzav, command the children of Israel. This time, the much softer word emor, say to the priests, the children of Aaron, is used. Why? There's a clue in the continuation of the first sentence of our portion. The sender actually begins, say to the priests, and then adds, and say to them. As the commentators don't believe the Torah is ever truly redundant, the Talmud teaches that there's a subtle message here. Be cautious in how we adults speak to children. Emor means to speak softly and kindly. Good advice in instructing children at any time. But why specifically is this word emor used twice in regard to the priestly commands? Priests, after all, are not children. Perhaps the essence lies in the central message of holiness given to our ancestors, articulated forcefully at the start of last week's portion of Kedoshim. You shall all be holy, for I, God, am holy. Here in Emor, as the specifics of the designated representatives of the people in holiness are articulated, the change to softer language is notable. Priests are the ones who have to help the people achieve holiness. They now must be given the careful, scrupulous requirements, but also inspired to do that work with devotion and passion. There will be a balance they must maintain between conscientious, obsessive attention to detail and finding a way to communicate the sacredness of their calling to the Jewish people, who are not as occupied with its process and may not be as emotionally invested in it as the priests themselves are. Thus the word used is emor, speak, explain, teach, inspire, not just daber, tell, command, order. In leading someone towards holiness, there must be a serious, conscientious devotion to quality. Badly performed rituals inspire no one, but there must also be a demonstrated process of caring about the way those processes are experienced by the devotees, even, perhaps especially, a love for both process and result. During this week of Portion Emor, may we be inspired to seriously and caringly seek holiness in our own lives through Jewish practice, and to seek to inspire others to find that holiness as well. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Karin Warsofsky, founder of Tribal Gatherings, will explain how going to Jewish camp as a young adult, whether you've ever gone before or not, can be a life-changing experience for Jewish identity. Find out why and how when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A Palestinian man was arrested trying to enter Israel through a West Bank checkpoint with a truck carrying powerful explosives, attempting a terrorist attack on Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel's 70th anniversary Independence Day celebration. Israeli guards found the explosives embedded in the truck's air conditioning system during a routine check of its roof. The vehicle was attempting to enter Israel at a northern border crossing and was carrying products marked as intended for border communities and agricultural goods for rural communities in central Israel. Police sappers defused the bomb. Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman said Israel's military would hunt for the jerks who planned this attack during our holiday. They will not sleep until we find them. That same day, a kite sent from Gaza to southern Israel carrying a firebomb set fire to an Israeli wheat field. That was the fifth time that's happened in the last 5 days. The Israeli airstrike last week in Syria targeted an advanced Iranian air defense system at the T4 base, and not just drone deployment, as previously reported. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu ordered the strike after conferring with U.S. President Donald Trump in hopes of preventing Iran from using the anti-aircraft battery against Israeli jets carrying out strikes within Syria. This marked the first time the IDF directly attacked live Iranian targets, facilities, and personnel. Seven Iranian Revolutionary Guards Quds Force members, including drone unit commander Colonel Mehdi Degan, were killed by the Israeli strikes. And in the U.S., the parents of Noah Posner, a six-year-old boy who was among the 26 people murdered in the massacre at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut in 2012, have sued radio talk show host Alex Jones for continuing to insist the attack never occurred. The suit against Alex Jones and his InfoWars website was filed last week in Texas, where Jones is based. Leonard Posner and Veronique De La Rosa are seeking $1 million in damages. Neil Heslin, father of another Sandy Hook victim, six-year-old Jesse Lewis, filed a similar lawsuit the same day. Noah Posner was the youngest victim of the December 2012 massacre by Adam Lanza, who forced his way into the school building in Newtown, Connecticut, and opened fire. Lanza killed himself at the school. He had shot his mother to death in their home prior to the attack in Newtown. The Posner lawsuit accuses Jones of false, cruel, and dangerous assertions. Alex Jones, Yamach Shmo, called the Sandy Hook parents crisis actors, which inspired conspiracy theorists to make death threats against them. During an April 2017 broadcast on InfoWars, Jones discussed an interview that De La Rosa gave CNN's Anderson Cooper shortly after the shooting in Newtown. Jones claimed that the Sandy Hook shooting was faked. A Florida Atlantic University professor, James Tracy, was fired back in 2013 after writing on his personal blog that Sandy Hook was a hoax and sending the Posners a letter demanding proof that Noah lived and that they were his parents. A Florida woman who pleaded guilty in 2017 to threatening Leonard Posner was sentenced to 5 months in prison. Lucy Richards, 57 years old, apologized for calling the shooting a hoax. Well, now, perhaps Alex Jones will be held accountable for the vile lies he has been broadcasting, denying that kindergarten student Noah Posner was murdered at Newtown in 2012. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back the two Jewish, Corinne Warsofsky, who is the incredibly energetic and bright founder of Tribal Gatherings, which is camp for people who either never got to go or didn't have a great experience or love it and want to go back or all of the above in their young adult period. She's originally from Boston and has worked in marketing, doing all kinds of things for Jewish and non-Jewish organizations, including, I'm sorry, I have to call on this. You staged flash mobs? You mean those don't just happen?
Surprisingly, there's a lot of orchestration that goes into a flash mob.
I noticed that wasn't the first thing you put on your resume, but so you've created this organization, Tribal Gatherings, which... tell us why you chose to locate the camps where you did and how that's worked out and how you see it evolving going forward.
So there is a gap in terms of engaging young adults. Post-birth rate, pre, you have kids and it's time to put them in a daycare somewhere. And generally that age gap is 26 to 36. And I am...
By the way, I can confirm that as someone who's worked as a congregational rabbi for a long time. You just don't see those folks around a synagogue very frequently.
So it's true. And like there, and that's not to say that synagogue engagement isn't a way to get people in the door, but I don't think that that's what people in their 20s and 30s are looking to do today in this moment. They want to tap into their affinity interests and they want to network and they want to do things that are cool sounding that don't necessarily have a Jewish bent to it. So the locations I chose are based on the largest populations of birthrate alumni. It's just where the largest concentrations are. And there are places where I either have or aspire to have local partnerships. Part of my goal is to serve as a grassroots entryway into local Jewish life. So tribal is a great way to get people in the door, but I also know this isn't the solution to permanent engagement. What I'm trying to do is get people to come to camp, realize that they can be Jewish and have fun and and everyday secular experiences can tie back to what it means to feel part of a Jewish community. And then I partner with Jewish organizations who work with the young adults after the experience ends. So my locations are based, A, where there are significant birthrate populations. The largest, the most concentrated areas are in, obviously, in New York, second in California, Southern California, and third outside Chicago. And those are places where I have partnerships with organizations that are doing interesting work and I feel are brand aligned and want to work with me leading up to camp, during camp, and after camp.
So aside, first of all, it's the 3 to 4 to 5 day programs?
They are 4-night, 3-day events. The idea is that we lead into Shabbat. I try not to start the programs on a Friday night because I like having 24 hours for us to build community just to make Shabbat feel more special.
Oh.
So it's 2 full days, 2 half days. I'm happy to talk more about the program later, but sure. The idea is people arrive on a Thursday, they leave on a Sunday. Some camps start on a Friday and end on a Monday. It's just depending on availability for that day.
When, people arrive, they come from their jobs, they come from, you know, their lives, and they arrive at camp. It's kind of like kids come into camp from all kinds of backgrounds, only the difference is none of these kids were there last year, right?
Correct. So 70% of people come alone also, which is something I'm very mindful of. And we survey people asking why they're coming and what they're looking to get out of this. So each event is, I would say, highly tailored to the people who come and to the regions that we're hosting in. So the Berkshires camp experience taps into what's special about the Berkshires or the Northeast, while the Southern California experience is very much like a West Coast kind of experience. So that's reflected both in the content of electives and programs that we offer, and also with who my local sponsors and partners are. So, for example, In the Northeast, our coffee comes from Dunkin' Donuts, but on the West Coast from Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf, because part of what makes it special is getting to feel a flavor for the local destination, as people say. And while most people come from a 3-hour driving radius of where these camps are located, many people do see this as a destination, and they turn it into a trip. Like we have people from Texas who come to the Berkshires camp or to the LA camp, or people from Ohio. We had somebody last year take a train ride. She rode Amtrak from Ohio to Los Angeles because she wanted to go on an adventure, and this was a chance for her to roll adventure and camp all into one and get out of her comfort zone. So it's important to me to like pull out the organic flavors of whatever region we're hosting in.
All right, weird question. It's Jewish. You have Shabbat. Do non-Jews want to come? How does it work?
Yes. So we have Shabbat. I say that on the Jewish spectrum, tribal is more ish than Jew. This is a very intentionally Jewish experience, but you wouldn't know it just from being there. Other than the fact that everybody is Jewish, this isn't a Hebrew school, and we're not looking to recreate Hebrew school. So I'll give you an example. We had our LA camp over Sukkot last year, and I think that if we just told people to come inside the sukkah, shake a lulav, smell an etrog, that would have been recreating Hebrew school, and I don't think that that would have been doing any good for the world. So instead, we talked about, on the very last day, we had everybody in our sukkah, and Reboot is one of the most amazing partners to work with, so we created this unplug zone in a sukkah, and we had these giant floor cushions everywhere, so it was a really comfortable space for people to hang out in, and then they get to go home knowing, oh, I got to hang out in the sukkah all weekend. But we had a conversation on what Sukkot was, and we were in Southern California, which has the most similar ecology to Israel than anywhere in the world. So they have a pomegranate tree near their soccer field, and we pointed it out and said, do you guys know that stage of blossoming that the pomegranate tree is in right now is the same in Israel? And they were like, ooh, say more. And we said, that's because this marks the end of the harvest season in Israel, and because we're in LA, we can see how similar that ecology really looks and feels. And oh, by the way, what does it mean that, you know, we eat pomegranates this time of year? And we talked about the 7 species and how these are harvested just through Sukkot. And we said, okay, wait, let's actually go back to our schedule and review what we did. So the very first thing that we did as a community was braid challah, and we decorated it, sprinkles, chocolate chips, the works. And we talked about weeding together our community. But that's wheat. Challah is wheat. The next activity was a shecheyanu with wine.
Wait a minute, I have to ask a question. In a world where everybody seems to go gluten-free,
We have gluten-free options.
Oh, there we go. Okay. I had to check. Sorry.
So at night we played Family Feud by Bunk. That was a big You're It Out session. The next day we all went on friend dates where we actually had a staff member come up with date ideas for two people to do, rolled them up on a piece of paper and stuffed them inside dates. So if you're not catching on, these are the seven species. Then Schmaltz Brewery came and we did a Havdalah happy hour with them. That's barley. We learned how to open a pomegranate in a sukkah. That's pomegranates. And we concluded with all of you. Now, granted, next year I would make that a martini bar instead, but yeah, the idea is that we're layering, we're layering in like meaning and ritual into everyday experiences of camp.
One last question. What's the age range for tribal gatherings?
The average age is 29. Most people who come are 26 to 36, but we get 21 to 45, which sounds like a huge stretch, but we really emphasize stage, not age. So if you want to be here at camp and you're ready to give your best at tug of war and not let go of that rope and make some dream catchers and tie-dye arts and crafts and go stargazing on the hill with a beer, we want you at camp. So come and join us. And it's really about wanting to be part of this incredible community and embracing the people who are there.
I want to thank Corinne Warsawski for a great visit on Too Jewish. And we'll have to get you back on and get more updates down the road.
Thanks, Sam. It was great speaking with you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our Too Jewish guest will be filmmaker Arnon Shorer of the new film, The Pirate Captain Toledano, discussing the fascinating subject of Jewish pirates and his new movie about them. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes for the 70th anniversary of Israel last week and still going, Eyal Golan singing Yisrael. My friends, may you have a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
יש לי ארץ, החלב נוגע בדבש, והישן נושן, עטוף ובחדש, והיא יפה קדושה. ועיר אחת גדולה עשויה כולה זהב ישראל היא הבית שלי ישראל החלום שלי ישראל כאן ועכשיו
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.